This is Late to the Party, episode 2.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgotten.
Hello, welcome to Late to the Party, episode 2. This is a Geeks Unleashed monthly book club podcast, and in addition to our weekly podcast, where we will work through what are considered some of the most essential graphic novels of all time.
Well, I'm Mark.
And I'm Jasmine.
And we are also joined this week, this month, by our guest host, Derek Flynn, who is an Irish writer, playwright, and musician. He's the author of 4 novels, Broken Falls, The Dead Girls, Blackwood, and The Dark. His second novel, The Dead Girls, was chosen as one of the best Irish books in 2018 by the readers of Ricochet Book Club, Ireland's biggest online book club. And he's also a lifelong comic fan and unabashed Alan Moore devotee. Thanks for joining us, Derek.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. So it's great to jump into our second episode with tackling quite a relevant book for our time. So V for Vendetta was originally written by Alan Moore and illustrated by David Lloyd, and it was serialized in the UK anthology Warrior in black and white between 1982 and 1985. Unfortunately, it wasn't finished. I think only the first 5 or 6 issues, they were sort of released as strips in Warrior, and then eventually DC Comics picked it up under their now defunct Vertigo line and published it as a 10 issue limited series. And as we know, it's been collected into graphic novels, and the book itself is split into 3 books. Book 1, Europe After the Rain, book 2, The Vicious Cabaret, and book 3, The Land of Do As You Please. The story is set in an alternate 1990s Britain after a nuclear war, which has left the nation under a fascist rule. The story opens up on our mysterious V, who saves a character called Evie Hammond, who we will see grow throughout this book. She joins him in her fight, his fight against the government. I've obviously been reading this book over the last few days, and it's really taken me back how current this writing is for a book that's 40 years old. There's so much of it jumped out at me. I've gone back and I've written quite a few comments about things that were said, and it's a book I'm definitely going to need to reread. There's so much in here. I think, Derek, you've read it 4 or 5 times or something, have you?
Yeah, I remember reading it initially. Actually, I remember reading one chapter years and years ago. I picked up, it must have been like the early 90s or something like that. I picked up an old copy of Warrior, and it was just a random copy. At the time, we didn't really have many comic shops in Ireland at the time, so you just kind of picked up random issues of things every so often. And I remember picking up a random issue of Warrior somewhere, and it was actually a V for Vendetta episode in it, but it was I think it was like in the chapter 7 or chapter 8 or something like that, the one that deals with the bishop. And that was the first time I ever read it. And I was just amazed by the storytelling in it. And it was still a good few years later then before I got my hands on the actual graphic novel that was collected then. And I remember reading it loads of times at the time and loved it. But I hadn't read it in a good few years until this week again. Like you, I picked it up just for the podcast to read it again. And like you, I was absolutely struck just by how fresh the writing is and how timely the themes of it are. You know, and as you say, there's so much in there, you know, to be unpacked, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. I think the first two books within I found a lot easier to digest, and then book 3 I found quite tough to digest because of the sheer volume of content in there. And I sort of was just going over it again this morning before we recorded, just writing things down that jumped out at me, and I was like, actually book 3 is almost probably the stronger of the 3 books, and just the theology in there and just the mindset and everything that Alan Moore's injected into this book. I was like, oh, I'm so on board with this right now. It's kind of almost what I needed to read. Having read this and finished it after Boris's announcement last night about a fresh wave of lockdowns in England for a month-long lockdown, and I was like, wow, this book is really like hitting home for me at the moment. So
yeah. Jasmine, I think the when you think of it like that, and you, the language that the likes of Boris and Trump and people like that use, it's so close to the language that's used by the government in V for Vendetta, you know, and always language that talks about it's for your own good kind of thing, you know. Yeah. And you know, these governments now are using the same language, and you can just see how easy it is for them to have come along. Like in the story, there's been a war or some kind of a nuclear incident or something like that, and places have been wiped out, you know, abroad, and England has to kind of self-isolate almost and become stronger and blah blah blah. And so you can see how easy it would be in an incident in a case like that for the far right just to take control, you know. And we've seen it, obviously, Jasmine, you've seen it in America, you know, how easy it is for the far right to take some little level of control, you know. Obviously they're not, you know, they're not in power as such, but they are resurgent, you know. Yeah. Thanks to Trump, you know.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where if I take it back to like September 11th, when right after that happened, we created an entire new branch of government, Homeland Security, which was never a thing before. We came out with the Patriot Act. And it's one of those things where at the time you're thinking like, okay, you know, we got hit at home. This really hurts. This is painful. And, you know, the government is going to step in and they're going to make sure something like this doesn't happen again. However, the further removed you are from those events, the easier it is for you to go back and look at it and say, holy crap, we gave away so much to get these agencies. And what do we, the people, get out of these agencies? You know, with the Patriot Act, we give up our privacy, but everybody's fine with giving up your privacy if it means that you get to stay safe, right? But when you read this book, it's one of those things. And one of my favorite parts in the early part of the book is when V is at the station and he's getting ready to take down the Eye. he says to the people, like, you brought this upon yourselves. Like, you stood there and you did nothing while the government came in and took all of these things away from you, and you were okay with it. So you're just as much at fault as the government is. And I had to put the book down like at that point, and I was like, wow, this is, I mean, I can, yes, it's fine for the people to be upset with the government, but for someone to call the people out the way that V did at that early stage in the book, I thought that was really, really powerful, because it was like, you are not innocent in all of this. You sat there and you watched it happen and you did nothing.
Yeah, you're so spot on, because funnily enough, I actually lived in New York for about 5 years and I was there for 9/11. We ended up coming back to Ireland about 6 months after 9/11, but I can so clearly remember all the things that happened around 9/11. And you're so dead right about the Patriot Act and all of that, and that kind of gung-ho attitude that people had of, you know, it's us against them. And, yeah, you know, and you can so see how something like that, how people could just hand over their rights, you know. Yeah. so very easily. And again, like, the timely thing of that book is that idea of the Patriot Act and everyone being watched and all your information being in the hands of government. And here you have this leader in the book who is literally watching everybody in Britain through these TV screens.
Yeah.
You know, you can see everything that's going on in their lives. It's amazing. You know?
Yeah, I was actually taken back by that speech, because I was like thinking he was going to like rally everybody, but actually comes in and he is rallying, but rallying in a way in which he's saying, look, you guys have done this yourselves. Like, right. I mean,
there's also a point at the beginning where Derek, you were saying earlier, like, the, some of the dialogue that in the movie he's a chancellor. They don't call him a chancellor in the book, but that the head guy of the government has to say. And at one point he's kind of like, I even made a note, I think it was page 39, so pretty early on in the book, he's like, we did what we had to do. All the, he uses racial slurs, all the darkies, the Nancy boys and the beatniks, it was us or them, us or them, don't you understand? And yeah, that takes me back to 2016, when our current president, before he became president, when he was on the campaign trail, literally got up on national television, was given a speech, and he literally called everyone from the entire country of Mexico rapist, and everybody was suddenly just like okay with it. And I'm like,
yeah,
you just characterize an entire country of people as criminals, and everybody is just like, oh well, you know, whatever.
He
didn't mean it. I'm like, oh my god, he literally just said it.
Yeah, isn't it amazing the way that kind of rhetoric, and of course we see it then with Charlottesville and all of that as well. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that kind of rhetoric can just become so matter of fact, and people are just like, oh yeah, well, okay, you know, there's bad people on both sides, you know, and people go, oh yeah, there's bad people on both sides, and you're like, well, no, there's fascists on one side, and then there's anti-fascists on the other side.
And that's the thing, like, we fought an entire world war to say that Nazis and fascism was bad, okay? An entire world war to say that. So to have all of this stuff happening again in 2020, which is, what, 80 years after the last world war that we fought, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that we have to have these conversations. It's ridiculous that we have to give room to these people. And it's ridiculous that government leaders are sitting there saying, oh, there's good people on both sides. There's no good side to fascism. There's no good side to being a Nazi. It's bad, period.
And I think for Moore, it goes back even before the World War, because he would be very much steeped in Spanish Civil War, where a lot of people, including George Orwell, went to fight in the Spanish Civil War on the side of the Republic and against the fascists. And so I think, for what's interesting, we were just talking a little bit about this before we came on air, is that we were talking a little bit about the film, and I think the reason Moore disliked the film so much was because it was set up as a left-right juxtaposition, you know, the left against the right, mm-hmm. and his thing was, no, it's anarchists against fascists, you know, and a lot of people who fought in the Spanish Civil War would have classed themselves as anarchists, and a lot of people who are even on the side of Antifa now would class themselves as anarchists. So it's very much an anarchist versus fascist thing, not a left versus right thing. And I think that's really important, you know?
Yeah, I think the film did really reduce it down to left and right. And I think I read somewhere that someone said that one of the biggest issues with the film was that they kind of Americanized the British side of everything that Alan Moore had written. So it moves away from the book in the sense that I can relate to the movie a lot more. I don't know how it is for you guys, since it feels more Americanized to me as an American.
I think when I was reading the book, like, so many things, like, I mean, take away all the political stuff and everything, but there was, well, not taking away the story, but there was so many things that jumped out at me. Like, there's a thing in there about kids doing the 11 plus, where my daughter at the moment is preparing for her 11 plus, which obviously you wouldn't know what that is, but it's an exam 11 year olds have to do before they go to senior school, which is 11 year olds to 16 year olds. And so they do the 11 plus, so that way when they go to senior school, they kind of know where their education needs are. And, you know, and I was like, oh, what? Like, I couldn't believe it. I was like reading this book thinking, this is from the 80s. And I was like, I didn't even realize the 11 plus had been around 40 years. So it's like,
you know,
wow,
they mentioned,
like,
something about the TV tax, which I laughed about because you had literally just told me about that TV tax like a couple of weeks.
Oh, the teletext thing.
Yes.
And then obviously they name loads of different areas within London, like Brixton and Palliser, you know, and all that kind of thing. I've been to Brixton quite a few times, and one of my best friends lives in Brixton, and there's just a lot of like English commentary in there, and little things for me. And so it's very rare. I've said this to you before, as a comic book lover, most comic books are set in and around America, so it's great to be able to read the odd one like V for Vendetta, which is set in England, and yes, it's a sort of a Nazi version of England, you know, like, you know, and it kept jumping out at me, actually. One of the things they kept saying was England prevails throughout, like, you know, because obviously we're surviving whatever has gone on outside of England. But yeah, so within the movie itself, like, you know, we're not reviewing the movie, but in comparison to the movie, it was a dumbed down version of this book. They took a lot from it. They simplified elements of it to probably make it easier. But I was shocked that 90% of the cast was English, which was great. Stephen Fry was in there and everything. That was good. But I was like, but the two leads are bloody Australian and American. Oh, no, actually, she's not American, is she?
She's American Israeli, I think, isn't she? Israeli background, but she's American, I think.
But when I heard her English accent, I was like, oh, it's not great. Like, and I was like, could they not have found some, like, really well-known Hollywood English actors to come in? Like, you know, I don't know. But it was still, I did enjoy the film. I loved the Englishness about this book. And like they mentioned, obviously, the Labour Party and the Tories and everything like that. And I was like, this is literally going on now, 40 years, and we've still not changed. It's still Labour versus Tories.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think like what's really interesting about that is it's still going on, but also it also preempted the stuff that wasn't going on then. So like I was saying to you earlier that I think it's more timely now because he wrote it in 82. And it's similar to George Orwell's 1984. Like none of that happened in 82 or 84, what he's writing about in the book. It didn't even really happen in 92 or 94, but it's all happening now. Like there's no, you know, there was no internet in 82. There was no smartphones. There was none of that kind of stuff. But yet what he was writing about was, like I said, this idea of the eye, this all-seeing eye, these security cameras. Mark, you'll know this all over England, especially these security cameras on every corner. You know, that only happened in the noughties as such. You know, that didn't happen even in the 80s or 90s. So it's actually, I think, so much more prescient now even than it was back then, you know?
Well, yes,
there's even a panel at the very beginning where someone says, "Make Britain Great Again." And I closed the book at that point, and I was like, "Are you shitting me? Like, Make Britain Great Again?" And we literally are in 2020 or 2016. It started with the whole "Make America Great Again," and it's like
Brexit, of course.
I'm not anti-technology. You know, I love, like, I've got a little Alexa in the house and stuff. I'm not like, because I just think, you know, I'm not up to anything. So like, if anyone was to bug my house, I don't think they'd hear much else than my kids squabbling every now and again. And you know, like, you know, but I thought, how weird is it that like he's predicting stuff that we have naturally allowed to happen to ourselves?
Right.
We've allowed surveillance to happen, you know, like social media and cameras in and outside of our house and cameras in the street. Like I've been at work before the lockdown. I've been at the work. So I work in a bank and I was on the third floor of one of our buildings and we got a camera that watches the street. And I remember once just seeing that camera moving as it was following some people on the street. And I was like, I did think to myself, like, I always wondered if those cameras were for show or not. And I was like, they're clearly not, because I could see them following a bunch of about six or seven youths during the day. And I was like, This is crazy. They're not. I thought they're not even doing anything. These kids.
Yeah.
They're just walking down the street. But obviously, somebody in some center somewhere thinks, well, those kids could do is just being watched. And I was like, okay, that just seems nuts to me. But yeah, so throughout the book, you obviously see a lot of commentary about, and you just, so you see like, obviously the eye, you know, listening, actively listening into people's homes. I mean, in the movie, obviously they show a van driving around the streets listening in, but they do it so well that they're just able to literally listen in and to what people are saying. And it's just literally accepted. And the thing that it jumped out for me as well was the sheer control of the media, how the government completely controls the news. And in real life, you can obviously say that, you know, the BBC is owned by the government, although they try and say that they're separate. You know, you've got to be honest, they're not going to outright slag off the people that pay them to be there. They're never going to come out and completely destroy Boris in the news, because that's where they get their money from.
It's the same in Ireland here as well. You know, like there's our national broadcaster is like your BBC, so RTE, and they will say that they're neutral, you know, but yeah, like you say, you get a lot of people saying, yeah, well, they're not really, are they? Because they don't come down on the government as hard as, you know, someone who's not affiliated with that organization would do, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, and then you have their Fox News in America, you know, and the president actually ringing up Fox News to have a conversation whenever he feels like it. I mean, that's almost like the voice
of
faith.
It's ridiculous is what it is. Yeah. I think it's in book two where V gives that speech, and I actually wrote a piece of it down. He says, "You've encouraged these malicious incompetents who have made your working life in shambles. You've accepted without question their senseless orders. You could have stopped them. All you had to say was no." And it's like, all you have to do is say no. And it's like people are terrified to do that these days.
Yeah, yeah. It's so true. And I mean, that literally is like the voice of fate coming out of the television when you've got Trump talking to Hannity on Fox News,
yeah.
You know, and telling blatant lies that people are actually going to believe.
Right.
It's so eerily prescient to what is in that book. You know, it's amazing.
I thought it was really sort of, the way that Moore framed the sort of backbone of the government, where you had the eye, the ear, the nose, the hand, like he laid out a really great kind of like allegorical diagram of how this government regime worked against the people, which that is not present in the movie. I mean, they talk about Fingerman and that sort of thing, but they don't break it down like the eye, the ear, the nose, the way that the book does. And when the book has it broken down like that, it is incredibly eerie the way that it all kind of just, once it starts to fall apart, it's almost backwards. Like once it starts to fall apart, that's when you can see the full picture. And it's really eerie how insidious all of the everything was. Like people were being, you know, not necessarily brainwashed, but they're being hit from so many different angles that you can understand why people are so complacent. It's because they have no recourse from it, right? Like it's everywhere they are, and you can't get away from it.
I think that's what's really interesting about it as well, because again, you didn't have 24-hour TV in 1982, and yet he does this thing early in the book where he's shown people being fed this diet of like soaps and sitcoms, and then these kind of right wing TV programs where the hero basically takes out people of color, and you know, and all this completely racist stuff, like, and they're just being force fed this constantly, and they just kind of sit back and accept that, and that just kind of becomes the thing, that becomes the norm. Yeah. You know, how much is that different from a lot of, you know, maybe a little bit before Netflix, because Netflix and the likes of that has maybe given us a little bit, you know, has pluralized things a little bit more, and we see more programs being made by minorities and stuff like that to a certain extent, you know, on stuff like Netflix and whatever. But when it came to, say, before Netflix, or maybe, you know, 10 years ago, and you looked at the major channels on your TV, whether it's in England or Ireland or in America, and the programs that they were putting out, how different was that to what Moore was actually saying in that book, just force feeding you this rubbish that was, you know, to a certain extent sexist or racist or whatever it was, and people just accepting that, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of the backlash, especially lately in America, well, not just here, but like all over the world, you see this kind of stuff going on in Nigeria and in places in South America too, where people are revolting against the police. But it's like, if you look at American TV, like you just mentioned, we've got a 40, 50 year history of serialized episodic TV programs that are filled with cops, and the cops are always the good guys, and they're always taking down the bad guys. I mean, you've got Law and Order that's been on TV here for 20 plus years, and it's kind of like, is that some sort of insidious thing where we have built up the police force to be like the heroes that are going to come in and save us, when really they're the ones that are at the forefront of keeping everybody sort of in check or complacent? So it's interesting the way that dynamic, the police dynamic, has fallen apart, especially within the last 3 years here in the U.S.
And of course, all the bad guys are always Hispanic or Black.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. The bad guys are always the brown people.
It even comes back to the Western movies, you know, that idea of manifest destiny, and you know, we were going to take over the West and take it back from the savages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the American people were fed that narrative, and that's the narrative they bought, and they looked upon the cowboy and the, you know, and the U.S. Army as the heroes, and the Native Americans, or the, you know, the indigenous peoples, as the savages and the bad guys.
Mm-hmm. It's a long history of it, but I think the creepiest part of the book, not just how timely it is and how you could literally pick this book up and overlay it with right now and it fits, but it's just, I always go back to the we let it happen. You know, the people are the ones that kind of, we let it happen. We didn't do anything to stop it. So how can we? You know, and I think that's sort of the underlying theme.
Oh, so yeah, the ongoing book. Theme, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like, well, because I think one of the biggest differences between Evie in the book and Evie in the movie, well, first of all, she's 16 in the book, and in the movie, I think she's like 24. But Evie in the book doesn't really have any sort of inclination to revolution or, you know, anything like that. She's just kind of like this random girl that gets caught up in this and then goes along with it because it seems like it's her best option. But it's like, how do we get people to actually give a shit? You know what I mean? Like, how do we get people to realize that this it's not going to change on its own?
That's definitely the journey that she goes through.
Government is never going to be like, oh, you know what? We're wrong. We're sorry about that. We're going to do better next time. Like, somebody has to be there to hold the people in power to account. And who are going to be the people that do that?
That's so really interesting, because Mark was just going to say there about Evie's journey. Like what she has to go through to become that person is so soul destroying, almost. You know, it's not just you're right, Jasmine. It's not just a case of you can just go onto Facebook and write a Facebook post and everything's going to change.
Right.
There has to be radical change.
Right. But you got to put in the work, and you got to be willing to make the sacrifices. In essence, she completely changed the person that she was based on everything that she went through. She's no longer the person that started this book. At this point, by the end of the book, she's a completely different character. But how many people are willing to completely tear themselves down in order to rebuild what's necessary to, and you're doing something that you probably aren't going to benefit from, right? You're laying this groundwork. You're going to be the one to make all these sacrifices and the changes, but the people that come behind you are going to be the people that end up benefiting from it. So you have to, it's like getting the right people to sort of take the charge. And I think that's one of my favorite parts of the book, is just kind of watching the old regime fall character by character by character, as not necessarily new people come in to replace them, but just kind of watching the old thing fall apart and watching something new be sort of built up. Even though it's never finished, there's no end, really.
You say about that, obviously, that where, he's building something that he knows that he won't see, and he says that as well. Mm-hmm. But when I did write this down as well, right at the very near the end of book three, where he says, there's no flesh and blood within his cloak to kill. There's only an idea. Ideas are bulletproof. So he knows that it's bigger than him and his imagery. And obviously that face has been used even outside this book for years. Like, people have taken that facial image and used it for protests and things like that as a way of, or anarchy basically, trying to take down a system. And it's just about more than the man under the cloak. And that's what's great, I think, actually, is that we never get to know who V is throughout the book.
Funny, when I originally read it, I was so wanted to know, years ago. And when I read it this time, I was like, why did I ever want to know? It's not important.
me and Jasmine love a TV show called Banshee, which went for 4 seasons. And you never find out who the main character is. Basically, on the first episode, he comes into town and takes over somebody else's identity. And when he leaves at the end of the fourth season, you never find out who he is. He just rides off into the sunset. And actually, who cares? He came in with a story arc, and it was basically this book reminded me of Banshee a little bit. Like, you don't need to know who V is. His story is actually about bringing down the government and essentially reminding everybody. And I mean, there's so many great quotes in this, like so many great moments in this that Alan Moore wrote. I wrote down another quote as well, which I thought was brilliant, about this couple in here about sort of the overthrow of the government. But it's like, since mankind's dawn, a handful of oppressors have accepted the responsibility over our lives that we should have accepted by ourselves. By doing so, they took our power. By doing nothing, we gave it away. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and literally we consume what they give us, we accept what they tell us. And that's when I read that last night, and again I read it this morning, and I was like, literally, we just accept what we're told and we just go along with it. And this book, honestly, I couldn't have read this book at a better time. If I'd have read this a couple of years ago, it probably wouldn't have had such relevance to me.
And as you said, Mark, I'm thinking the exact same thing when I finished it. I think I really need to go, as many times as I've read it before, I just saw it in a whole new light when I read it this time, and I was like, you know what, I need to go back and read this again, because there's so much there that's speaking to me now that didn't speak to me maybe 10 or 15 years ago,
I think Mark and I actually wrote down the same quote without knowing it, but in book three is my favorite book. By the end, it's just kind of like, it was such a page turner by the end that I couldn't slow down when I was reading it. And there's one quote in book three that takes up I think 3 or 4 pages all across the panels, where V says, it doesn't do much to rely on the silent majorities, for silence is a fragile thing. One loud noise and it's gone. But the people are so cowed and disorganized that a few might take the opportunity to protest, but it'll just be a voice crying into the wilderness. Noise is relative to the silence preceding it. The more absolute the hush, the more shocking the thunderclap. Our masters have not heard the people's voice for generations, and it's much, much louder than they care to remember. And I think that that is, it's, if you were to have like a rallying cry for this book, it would have to be that sentiment that people have been quiet for too long. And if you open your mouth and actually say something, the government would be shocked to A, to hear your voice, but B, to hear what it is that's coming out of your mouth.
And I love the way he juxtaposes, or David Lloyd juxtaposes that with the imagery. Because over the lines that you just quoted, you see people in a crowd, one guy stands up and then the next guy stands up and then they're all, you know, and that's it. It's like a actually, of course, the domino effect thing that he's playing with.
It only takes one. Like that's basically what he's saying. It takes one, like one person, just like if you're stuck in traffic on the freeway, it happens here all the time. Sometimes if traffic is really bad, one car will like hop the curb and like get off the freeway where there is not an exit. All it takes is one. So one car does it. And now 50 cars are going to do the same thing. You know, it's one, it takes one person to stand up and say something. And you can see that with all of the protests that we've had where cities were shut down, streets were shut down. Nobody could get anything done. When people finally stood up here and said, look, we are sick and tired of you killing unarmed Black people. Like, this is ridiculous. And when that happened, it was like, what do you mean people are protesting in the streets and traffic is blocked and this, that, and the other? And it's like, people are tired. People are tired of being oppressed. People are tired of being treated like they don't matter. So if you're not going to listen to our concerns in constructive ways, then we have to be disruptive, because what other option do we have?
And of course, then that was taken in the same way as the Charlottesville thing was taken, and it was painted as, you know, well, you know, the cops might be a bit heavy-handed, but these protesters are just as bad,
right.
You know. Which, and so you had that thing, you know, yeah. So you had that thing again of, well, there's bad guys on both sides, you know. And it's like, no, there's not, you know. Again, it's an armed police force who are killing unarmed civilians. Like, mm-hmm. That's not an equal thing, you know? And I think even over here, on a very, very minor extent in Ireland, we have this far, far right group who style themselves on the Yellow Vests from France, and they're nothing like the Yellow Vest movement in France, because they're basically a homophobic, xenophobic, racist organization. Now, they're very small, but they're very vocal. And we had a protest outside our parliament building about 6 weeks ago, and there was a number of peaceful anti-fascist protesters there. And one of the anti-fascist protesters was beaten with a bar and had her head split open, a woman. And 2 weeks later, they decided the fascists were going to have another protest. Now, the numbers were really small because people are starting to see through them, you know. But they're using this populist thing like Trump of basically saying, you know, oh, it's about individual freedom and liberty and you shouldn't have to wear masks and all this nonsense. But a bunch of anti-fascists turned up and there was a fight, basically. And we ended up with our media over here, some of our media over here, doing the exact same thing as Trump and saying, well, there's just as bad on both sides. You know, and that really sprung into my mind last night when I was finishing up the last section of mm-hmm. the book. And I was just thinking, like, this is insane. You know, this rhetoric that they're selling in the book is the same rhetoric we're being sold in America, in England, in Ireland, all over Europe, that they're two sides of the same coin. They're not. Right. You know, there's fascists, which, as Jasmine said, we thought we'd done away with in 45. And then there's people who want to punch fascists,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
And that's pretty much it, you know?
Yeah, I felt like the third book, they introduced that little girl character with the glasses and the pigtails. And like after they kind of take down the cameras, there's one scene where she goes up to one of the cameras and she says, bollocks. And she like cowers down and she like waits for something bad to happen to her, and then nothing happens. And then she just like runs around the streets yelling, bollocks, bollocks, bollocks. And I got such a kick out of that, because I'm like, that's probably like, this girl couldn't be more than like 10 or 11 at the most. So her entire life, she's lived under this sort of oppressive government. You couldn't curse, you know, like, and to see her just have so much joy in like literally running down the street cursing. I mean, it's so great to see that kind of stuff, like, as the book progresses, where people are starting to see these small changes themselves. And just think, like, this girl now cursed. So she's going to become some kind of, like, revolutionary, because now she can curse without being fear of being, like, put in prison or beaten to death or something ridiculous.
And you guys are reading out your quotes, and the one that jumped out at me, and it sums up what you're saying there, Jasmine, is when he says to Evie, "I didn't put you in prison. I just showed you the bars."
Yeah, I showed you the bars. Yeah, oh my god, I love that one.
That's a good line. Yeah.
Yeah. To me, that kind of sums it up as well. You know, everything that we're talking about and everything that the book is about. You've been living inside this prison your whole life. You just didn't know, and I'm just here to show you that. You know.
Yeah.
I was gonna say with Evie, like, there's sort of throughout the book, there's three sort of pillars that kind of jump out at me. There's the one pillar was with the bishop. So obviously for a book written at the beginning of the 80s, how Alan Moore was not afraid to comment on the fact that this bishop clearly is a paedophile. Mm-hmm. And like, that's something probably, I mean, obviously I was born in 81. I can't imagine it was something that was really talked outright. Now it's kind of very much known about that these things did happen in Catholic churches and sort of all boys' homes and things like that, where these unfortunate people of power did take advantage of their position. And I can't imagine, like I say, in the 80s, that it was as talked about. And I can imagine it was very much covered up. But in this book, obviously, she shows up and, you know, his sort of PA or something goes, "Oh, the agency have sent down a girl a little bit older than you like, etc." And I was like thinking, I knew where this was going. And I was like, I can't believe, like, even his assistant is, like, on board with basically the fact that his boss, the bishop, is a paedophile, and walks in, and obviously Evie's dressed up as a little schoolgirl, but she obviously goes in undercover to open the window so V can get in. And I was sort of quite taken back by that scene and just the social commentary in there. I mean, Alan Moore obviously loves social commentary. And then, but the next part was the most gruelling part, about how he... Evie obviously leaves V for a little while, and then he kidnaps her and takes her back under the guise that he's the government and puts her through a huge ordeal. And like, you know, what you said, Derek, about he essentially through that process shows her the bars. And I love it at the end when she's leaving the prison, he says something like, "You're free to go." And I just felt like that was, you're not just free from this prison, you're actually free. Like, he'd kind of just changed her mindset throughout that process. And, you know, he did show her, the bars, like you say. So
I think Alan was probably thinking of that. I don't know if you guys have heard of that, the Plato's myth of the cave, where he used this analogy that everyone was sitting at a wall, sitting facing a wall in a cave, and there was a fire behind them, and they were just looking at the shadows on the wall. And then someone comes in and tips them on the shoulder and goes, "Look," and they walk outside and they see the whole world. And it's that idea that you've just been watching these shadow puppets almost all the time, you know, mm-hmm. and you've only been seeing a part of reality. And then someone walks in and just grabs you and pulls you out into the daylight and goes, "Oh, look," you know. And that's a really good point, Mark, what you're saying as well about the church. Because obviously, like, Ireland had one of the biggest, before America did, Ireland had one of the biggest, reveals of what actually went on in the Catholic Church. But we didn't have it till the 90s. So no, there wasn't any mention of any of that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, it was 88 or 89 when Sinead O'Connor tore up the picture of the Pope on SNL. And even then, that was, like, hugely controversial. So it wasn't until early to mid 90s that we really started to deal, and we're still dealing with the after effects of what happened with the church in Ireland. So yeah, I mean, that was a brave move by Moore in the 80s to do that.
Yeah, there is another quote in the book toward the end where, Mark, you were saying, like, how can the assistant, the priest assistant, like, do this? Like, you know that you're doing wrong, but you're doing it anyway. But there's a quote at the end that says, "Authority, when first detecting chaos at its heels, will entertain the vilest schemes to save its orderly facade." And I think that's one of those things where some people realize that they're never going to have the power, so they cling to the people in power, regardless of what those people are doing. It's like those kinds of people have set aside their morals and their ethics altogether just for the sake of staying alive, even if staying alive does not actually mean living a life. And I think that the people that, like, the assistant with the priest and that kind of thing, and all of the other enablers, the enablers that were at the TV station, the enablers that were part of the government party, like, just the sort of like the peons, like, they do these things because they want to be able to keep doing things, not necessarily because they have any greater purpose or because they understand. Well, I'm sure they understand right from wrong, but, like, they choose to ignore it because they have what they think is their safety net. And you really see that kind of play out with the whole character of Susan, or what is the woman's name? I can't remember her name, but she's basically trying to puppeteer. She wants her guy to be the next chancellor instead of Creedy.
Oh, Helen.
Yes,
Helen.
Thank you, Helen. Hiya, Helen. Yeah. And, like, the way that she plays those two guys against each other, the Irish mobster and the guy that's next in line behind Creedy, she's a prime example of one of those. Like, she's an opportunist beyond measure. And it's just one of those things, like, people, when people see an opening, like, or you know how the saying goes, like, power hates a vacuum. So it's people will step up and step into positions just to keep themselves alive, regardless of what they have to do it.
It's also interesting, Mark, that you're talking about that chapter with the bishop, because I was saying to you, when I picked up originally the issue of Warrior and I knew nothing about V for Vendetta, that was the episode that I read. Just from a storytelling perspective, it's an amazing episode, because he doesn't do it in linear fashion, and you don't see any of the stuff happen really on screen as in the narrative as such. You see it happen in the artwork, but so he has these detectives talking about, and this is the part where this happens, and this is the part where that happens, and they're talking about it, and meanwhile juxtaposed with that is these images. And I just found it, the first time I read it, I just found it mind-blowing, just the way he did it as a storytelling technique, apart from the themes of what was going on in it as well, you know, which at the time to read that was a big deal as well. But just the storytelling aspect of it, I think, was amazing. And it was the first time I'd seen Moore's name, and I was just like, who is this guy? Because, I think when you look, he wrote that in 82, and he wrote Swamp Thing in 84, and Swamp Thing was kind of the one that really brought him to prominence in the States and stuff. But I think V for Vendetta is a way better written book than Swamp Thing, because I think it's tighter, it's closer to Watchmen in its storytelling technique, and in the tightness of its use of narrative and stuff like that. Swamp Thing can be a little bit flowery prose and a little bit, you know, all over the place, a little bit florid, as they would say. And I like Swamp Thing, but I just think V for Vendetta, as one of Moore's works, I think it's definitely up there with Watchmen. It just in the economy of storytelling and the, you know, how good he is at using all these things. And like you said about the last third of the book, the way he brings all of those characters together in that last third of the book, and the way he manages to tell all their stories and have it all, you know, just come to this climax. It's brilliantly done.
He has an amazing ability to tell a very specific story, but at the same time, that specific story is universal. Like, this is set in England. It's very English in the things that it talks about. Some of the things I didn't understand, like Mark was saying, that 11 plus thing, I had no idea what that meant. I just glossed over that and kept going. But, like, the overall theme of the book can translate to anywhere. I mean, and that, I think, is what's so great about the book. It's, yes, this is very British, yes, it's very specific, but at the same time, like, it was very easy to pull my own government out of this book, you know what I mean, like, but to pull my own neighborhoods out of this book, it was uncanny how easy that was.
And that comes back to what Mark was saying about the organized the groups that adopted the V mask for all those things. Like, I remember when the 1% movement the 99% movement did that, and they adopted the V masks. And I remember seeing a video of Moore actually going down to one of their protests in England and talking to them and stuff. And then they were talking to Moore himself, and he was totally on side with these guys because he saw that they got the message better than, say, the guys who made the movies or whatever. You know, they got that it was anarchists versus fascists. Mm-hmm. And not a left-right thing. So I think, you know, he didn't like the way it was depicted in the movie, but when people in real life actually did it, he was 100% behind them. You know, he thought, yeah, you guys are, this is exactly what I was talking about. You know? Yeah.
There's there's one line in the movie that is not in the books, but I think it sort of sums up everything and is a really succinct line when V says, people shouldn't fear their governments, government should fear their people. And I think that's an overall theme that was in the book. But I think that when the movie kind of made that one concise sentence, that sums it up so, so, so well. Like, we shouldn't be like that little girl staring at a camera thinking like, oh, I'm going to get my ass beat if I say, you know, if I curse in front of this camera. Like, we should not be afraid of the people that are supposed to be protecting us. They should be worried about protecting us. I was kind of disappointed because I had seen the movie first before I read this book. I saw the movie when it came out back in 2005 or 2008. So to not have that line in the book, I was like, oh man, but I see that that's the theme for the entire book. And the movie just kind of summed it up in a very concise manner.
No, but what I was going to say was, obviously we talked a lot about the writing, but the artwork obviously makes up a big chunk of reading anything that's a comic or a graphic novel. David Moore is obviously David Lloyd, obviously the illustrator. Coloring is with David Lloyd, Steve Whitaker, and Siobhan Dodds as well. And now I'm having to be trying to take a standpoint that I'm reviewing this 40 years after it was made, and I'm used to reading a lot of more modern comics and graphic novels, so my expectations from artwork is going to be different from what's been made 30, 40, 50 years ago. So the artwork isn't something I would say I love, but actually I've sort of had to take a stand back. I actually do like the illustrations that David did. It's actually what I can't really get on board with is the colouring. I don't really like the colouring as much, and I think me and Jasmine were talking a little bit about this before, was some of the colouring didn't really make sense. It kind of just seemed to change throughout the book. Like, I don't know whether or not there was a purpose to it, but
seemed like there were different colour schemes for different characters.
So. Yeah, and it wasn't colored originally when it came out.
Yeah, no, it was black and white. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, it was black and white. Yeah, and Lloyd's artwork is well suited to black and white, and of course the story is as well. Yeah. But I guess, you know, they felt they needed to color it for Vertigo once Vertigo took it on board. But yeah, I agree. Absolutely agree with you. I think it would be better. I think it's a graphic novel that would be better read with just the original black and white artwork rather than the colored artwork.
Yeah, I think I might have gotten better with it being black and white.
I like the big, like, full-page panels that are in color. A lot of those are really great.
And I think, though, Jasmine, they were added. I might be wrong now, but I think they were added either for Vertigo or even just for the later collections, because I remember reading back in the day, and I don't remember, like, the original collection. I don't remember those being in it. I think David may have actually added those in, and I love those as well. I think they're brilliant as well. But his painted work like that, the front covers and those pieces are actually, they're really good. But the coloring then just, that's because that's his own painted work. But yeah. Then when you have someone else coming in just to color his work, it doesn't look as good. Yeah.
Well, I think if I didn't know any better, I would say that it was like a noir. Like if I didn't read the book and I'm just looking at the illustrations, it looks very much like a old crime noir kind of novel. Like that's the style that it's drawn in, and that's something that I can appreciate because I do love noir, like especially like old like Hollywood kind of stuff that's still in black and white.
I think Moore mentioned in one of the introductions I was reading the 30th anniversary one.
Yeah, that's the one I have.
Yeah, and he mentions in the back of that, he talks about the whole process with David Lloyd. I think he mentions that Lloyd was actually working on a strip for a UK magazine at the time. I forget the name of it now, but it was like that. It was a noir. It featured this noir character. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the reason kind of Moore tapped him, because he loved that whole look and he wanted that look for his time. Well, I think he might have said it, actually it started out as a different time period as well. He was thinking about maybe doing a 30s, 40s thing, and then he updated it then. But yeah, that's why he tapped David Lloyd, because he does have that noir feel down in his artwork.
And I think the
the graphic part of the novel, it's done to great effect. There are several chapters where when you're reading, it's like there's five or six panels where there's no dialogue whatsoever. Uh-huh. And it's just the graphics that are pushing the story forward. And we were talking before we started recording, and Mark kept saying that the faces of the people are really expressive. So to have that pause and to see just, you know exactly what's happening based on the expression on these people's faces. So the coloring was strange. And at some point I did pause and I was kind of like, so every time Evie's on, is it like pinks and yellows or am I making this up? So like, I did have questions about the colors, but reading the story, like the old school feel with the sort of, you know, fascist, anti-fascist vibe, I thought it worked well together.
I think Lai did a good job of laying it out as well, because, you know, you think back to, you're talking early 80s, long time before widescreen comics and all that kind of stuff. And I think he's done a nice job of, you know, there's a lot of tight panels, but then there's a lot of expansive panels that come in certain points. And then he has that whole Fish's Cabaret episode where it's just a musical, basically, you know. And so I think he actually does a nice job on Moore's, because I know Moore is fairly strict with his layouts anyway, so a lot of that would have been his, he would have suggested those. But I think Lloyd executes it very well, you know, at a time when they were doing it, you know, they weren't working for Marvel, they weren't working for DC, they were working for a small UK publisher, they were, you know, working with the tools they had. I think he did a pretty good job, you know.
I think so. In summary, I would say that I'm really pleased that I've read this. This is a book that's been sitting on my shelf for years. Like, it's one of those books, you know, like, that's the whole reason we started this podcast, was so that we could start working our way through graphic novels that we should have read, you know, as comic book lovers. Like, I mean, obviously Derek has read it several times, but me and Jasmine, we love comics, but we're more people that read current stuff, and we're like, you know, we need to go back and read maybe older stuff, you know, like, to really appreciate the format of comics. And I'm so pleased that I've read this, like, now, where this is just so, you know, so suited to this moment in time.
Yeah.
But there's so much in here that it needs to be reread. Like, where I think last month when we read Mouse, it was quite a depressive hard book, and we were like, it would take a lot to go back to. But this book,
yeah, I know, absolutely, yeah.
So with this book, I would definitely go back and reread it, and yeah, I wouldn't want to leave it that long either, so it's still fresh in my mind. I'm not as keen on the colouring, but I love the artwork. I don't know if there's a black and white version of this out there, but I would be keen to probably find a black and white version, because I think the colouring took away a little bit from this book for me. But other than that, I really enjoyed this. So
I think this book is a testament to the people who say that comics are superheroes and nothing else. Like, you're an idiot if that's really what you feel. Because this book, I mean, there have been novels that I have read that have not made me feel the way that this book made me feel. So the storytelling in V for Vendetta is phenomenal. Whether you agree with what's going on or not, I mean, I can't deny that this is a fantastic story. There was never a point in time where I got bored reading it. There was never a point in time where I was like, oh, why did we pick this book? But there were definitely points in time where I put everything on pause and I was like, okay, I need a minute to, like, digest this, because that was a lot to kind of take in. So this book really, really, really hit home. And I mean, I cannot recommend it enough. I think, especially right now, given this point in history, I think everybody should be reading this book.
Yeah, I think the main thing that hit me reading it again, as I said earlier, was just, I was delighted that it held up so well. And the writing, as you said, Laz, like, the storytelling is just fantastic. Yeah, I think the art is great as well. You know, whatever. I'd agree with Mark. I think that there should be a black. I think if there was, like, a director's cut or whatever of it, or the 30th anniversary thing, they should have just made it the original thing, you know, what it was supposed to be. But no, I think the amazing thing about V for Vendetta, I think there's so many ideas in it. Like, it's like what you were saying, Jasmine, you just have to stop sometimes and just think, whoa, I need to take that in for a second. You know, there is so much in it, and it definitely deserves a second read. And it's definitely, I'd say for me, it's up there with one of some of Moore's best works, without a doubt.
100%. Well, Derek, thanks for joining us on this month's, on our second episode.
Thanks for having me, lads. I'm delighted to spell all my morisms and my love for Viva Vendetta.
I think you've made this episode really enjoyable, to be honest, with your knowledge of more. And
I feel like we could go on talking forever.
I know. I was thinking, but at some point we must end the show. Yeah. But we'd love to know, though, have you got anything yourself coming up that you'd love to sort of tell everyone about?
Yeah, so I actually have a new book. It's a shorter book than the normally my novels are novel length. But I had this idea to start working on some shorter pieces. So I'm calling them shortcuts, and they're basically going to be about 100 page novels. But they'll be full. They're not short stories. They're full novels, characters, the whole works. Just a shorter kind of what you would have, I suppose, called a novella years ago or whatever, you know. And so I've got the first one of those is coming out in November 17th, and that's called The Lotus Eaters. And that will be available on Amazon in paperback and in ebook as well.
So because when you say, obviously, there's sort of several, are they going to be connected, the other ones that you're talking about, or are they just different stories?
Well, this one is going. The first one I'm going to do is a prequel to three of the four books that I've written previously. One of them was a standalone, but the other three were about this private detective character, John Ryan. And this story is going to be a prequel to those. So you won't have to have read the other ones. It's just an early story from his life, basically. But for those who have read the other ones, it's kind of a nice little thing because they get to have a flashback to something that happened to John before the other books, basically. But the other shortcuts that I'm going to be working on, they'll be just self-contained books. I just like the idea because I've got some ideas for books that I know are stories that aren't going to stretch out to 300 pages. And I don't want to be trying to, you know, put in filler or whatever to get 300 pages. So I just thought, you know what, if you've got a 100-page story, write a 100-page story and put it out there and see what happens, you know?
Yeah,
I wish more people thought that way.
some of the best stories are novellas. I've read a few novellas over the years, and I by the time it's come to an end, I've actually really enjoyed it. And like you say, it's not... You know, they haven't disappeared off to the countryside middle of the book to go and see their auntie for four chapters.
I was writing an article about this, and funnily enough, when I did a bit of research, I found that like the likes of Mice and Men and Animal Farm and all these famous novels, they're all like clocking at around 100 pages, which is really funny. You know, people don't realize that. And sometimes I guess you might get these, you know, expanded editions with loads of essays and stuff in them. So it seems like they're bigger books. But when you actually look at it, a lot of them are just 100 pages or a little over 100 pages, you know?
Yeah, they keep to the point throughout the story, which is hopefully keep more people interested. So thanks again, and also where can people find you, Derek, online?
So basically best places to go to if you're on Facebook, it's Derek Flynn Books or Derek Flynn Music. So I do a bit of both, so I have a page for both of them, so you'll find any of the book stuff on Derek Flynn Books on Facebook, or you'll find the music stuff on Derek Flynn Music on Facebook as well.
Brilliant. So go give Derek a like there. Next month, we will be reviewing the Scott Pilgrim Volume 1, Precious Little Life. We won't be reviewing all six of them, but just the first volume. So please read along with us. You can also follow us on social media. We're Geeks Unleashed on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
And you can get this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Podbean, Google, Apple, Spotify, we are everywhere.
Thank you very much, and tune in next week for episode 23 of Geeks Unleashed, and have a good week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Why won't you die? Beneath this mask, there is more than flesh. Beneath this mask, there is an idea, Mr. Creedy. And ideas are bulletproof.